reports on November 16th, 2005. Okay, Bill, you had some more comments you were going to make because you're in India after you, okay, after you got chewed out by the little guy. Oh, bakshish, Sam.
Well, the first plea that I heard from the little kids was bakshish, Sam.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as I was in India a little longer, I found that in the towns and cities, the more common plea was from the little kids, Bakshi Saab, no mama, no papa, no brother, no sister, Bakshi Saab. Okay. And as I said, I was 6 months in India, and then I was in Burma, China for 18 months, and at the war's end, I took the plane from my base in China back down to Calcutta, where we caught the ship home. And when I, after 16 months in China, I found when I arrived back in Calcutta that the little folks were even better educated. then the cry was, Bakshi Saab, no mama, no papa, no brother, no sister, no per diem, no flight pay, Bakshi Saab. That was one of the lighter moments over there. The poverty, of course, in India was very, very, it was difficult to see, and difficult with a helpless feeling, of course. But in China, evidently it seemed like the children had been instilled with the, you might say with more pride. We didn't have that sort of thing.
Maybe
in China. No, they seem to have more pride in that in that respect. Charlie, before we commenced the interview, I brought up the subject.
John Birch.
John Birch Society.
Yes,
and, I asked you if you thought a mention of this would be of interest. We agreed that we both remembered the John Birch Society and their anti-communism agenda, and I mentioned that in the 60 years since I was over in China, I had never yet met a person who knew who John Birch was. Well, my first assignment when I went to China, I was in Kunming in southwestern China for about a month of waiting assignment, and delightful climate there in the Kunming area.
But after a month, I was sent into as far as unoccupied China was concerned, this was northern China. And I suppose we were 300-400 miles north of the wartime capital in Chongqing, and I was at a place called Hanchong. We weren't too far southwest of where the Yellow River makes a right angle bend, comes west and then turns straight and heads north again. Well, we all have in mind, of course, a rough idea of the shape of China.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it's easy for us to visualize the east coast of China, a somewhat rounded east coast, and a heavily populated east coast. And cities on the east coast, like, well, the one I think of first is Shanghai, but I believe, Hankou, maybe I better not go out on a limb that far. But anyway, then to the west, quite a distance, there's a major north-south railroad. I don't recall just where it originates. I believe I misspoke when I mentioned Hankou being on the east coast. No, I think Hankou is on the Yangtze River, fairly far from the coast, as I recall, and this major railroad runs north and south through Hankou and straight up into northern China. Well, north of the Yangtze River and east of this railroad and west of the China coast was a fairly vast area, a couple hundred miles across it, which was of no particular military or strategic importance whatsoever. And we had a detachment of soldiers and OSS people, that's Office of Strategic Services. I am not sure, but what some of those maybe were civilians. And they were out in this area, we referred to it as a guerrilla area. And our military people there were under the command of an Air Corps captain. Yes, I believe he was Air Corps. Captain John Birch. We referred to this guerrilla area as Roger Two Sugar. I believe that was probably their radio call letters. Captain Birch's men, of course, took some quite comprehensive weather observations. observations and transmitted them to us by radio, of course, which were useful. Another function that my pilot colleagues appreciated was this. If we had possibly photo recon planes or possibly our light bombers out to the East Coast, and they would get shot up badly and wouldn't be able to make it all the way home, they were often able to make it back safely into this guerrilla area. And once they got on the ground there, Captain Birch was able, with his Chinese contacts and undercover people and so on and so on, to get them back safely to their across the Japanese lines to their home base. Some of our 10th Weather Squadron personnel were with Captain Birch out there in the guerrilla area, and I was a little amused at one point when one of our weather personnel was our detachment headquarters in Kunming, was assigning this sergeant or whatever to the guerrilla area and to Captain Birch's detachment, and the fellow that in charge of sending him out there was a fellow that I knew. I had finished the course in Chicago with him, and he was in my shipment overseas, and this fellow name was Lundeen, was trying to calm this fellow's qualms about being in an area that was totally surrounded by the enemy. And he said, "Oh, don't worry. I think you're safe there. The U.S. Navy will protect you." And the fellow, of course, could not understand this. They were hundreds of miles from the ocean. How was he going to be protected by the U.S. Navy? Well, sensing his qualms, Lundeen said to him, "You see, the U.S. Navy has such a tight blockade on Japan that they will not attempt to send a force across the Sea of Japan to attack you people." So the enlisted man being sent out there decided, well, I guess he's telling me that we just aren't worth being shot by the Japanese, and he calmed down. Actually, when any of our escaped prisoners of war or pilots was in trouble, got into the guerrilla area. They were first taken charge of by the Chinese communists. Mm. And there was sort of an uneasy truce reported that the Chinese communists treated them well, but more or less held them in captivity for a period for propaganda purposes before they were turned over to Captain John Birch to be smuggled back into safe territory. Well, to proceed with this question, who is John Birch? I told you who John Birch was, and of course we recall that the armistice ending the conflict was signed, wasn't it around August 16th?
Somewhere in there.
And immediately after the armistice, Captain Birch was murdered at the hands of the Chinese communists. He wasn't merely murdered, he was brutally murdered. They say his body was hacked into many pieces, but at the time of the end of the war, Birch and some of the OSS personnel, they were kind of divorced from the major part of the Roger Two Sugar personnel. And they were off on some kind of a mission, split off from the main body. And as I've described, how Captain Birch was murdered, and but the rest of the OSS personnel were just taken prisoners. I don't know for how long by the Chinese communists. But the prevailing thinking over there was that a lot of our supplies that had to be flown over the hump did not all find their way into the hands of the nationalist Chinese to be used in the conflict against the Japanese. But a lot of them were being rat-holed into the hills by the Chinese communists for later use against the Chinese nationalists. And I guess later events serve to underline this, what you might call a rumor. Let's see.
So then that's when the John Birch Society grew afterwards as an anti-communist thing. They took the name from John Birch, who
that's why the society took their name.
Yeah.
Yes.
To be anti, of course.
Let's see. Have I overlooked any thing here? I might just scan. Were there entertainers? Oh, yes. Oh, yes. There were some entertainers.
Where you were at?
Oh yes, even in northern Burma, I believe, and in India bases, And in China, there were entertainers. Some of them were real troopers. Like Jogi Brown and
he was there.
And so on, and Paulette Goddard, I recall, and but then there were some that found it quite rugged over there, and really lacked the comforts of Hollywood, California, and they bailed out early and didn't see their entire commitment through to conclusion. What did I do when I was on leave? I never was on leave. Yeah. Well,
you were located where it'd be pretty hard to be on leave.
I was absent from the United States for 28 months. And of course, as I've indicated, traveling by boat, about, 3-4 months of that were travel on boat. But we up close to Tibet.
Mongolia?
I can't say the name.
Nepal.
We had a rest camp up in the Nepal vicinity, where troops were under stress, I guess, got sent, but it wasn't offered to me. No, I was never on leave in my nearly 4 years in the service.
Is that right? Now, where you were at in Burma, is that where Joe Stillwell's Air Force was, or was that different?
Yeah, I did mention that in northern Burma, I was on this Lido Road, which was being constructed by General Pick of the U.S. Engineer Corps, being constructed to join up with the upper part of the Burma Road. One thing I forgot to mention was at this place called Shengguyang, we were just a few miles from where the Chinese troops under the command of General Stillwell were pushing the enemy southward.
Okay.
Yes. And
you didn't then you get well I interrupted you, but you didn't get any you didn't have any leave for all that period of time you were in the military then.
No,
that's interesting.
No, I didn't get to come home before I went overseas.
Oh my gosh.
A brief mention of coming home.
Yeah.
See, where did you travel? I've mentioned that. Humorous events. What did you think of all? Oh, here's one. Stop me, Charlie, if I'm proceeding too long.
No.
What did you think of officers or fellow soldiers? Oh, yes, this reminds me of something. A couple things, perhaps. Generally speaking, I felt highly of the troop, the enlisted men under my command and my fellow officers, but I must say that I got my best and greatest cooperation from the higher-ranking officers. One example is when I was sent to Burma to set up this weather station. It was not a forecasting station. We didn't need too much equipment. It was merely an observing station that sent out weather reports. But there were some problems. I was in India when I got the telegram from the headquarters in Calcutta, and it told me this. It said, proceed to Chabua, that was up in northeastern India, the Assam Valley, and that was a takeoff place for flights over the hump. Mm-hmm. Said, proceed to Chabua, contact Major, what's his name, at AT&C there. AT&C is Air Transport Command, and their workhorse airplane was the old reliable C-47. And it said, contact him regarding for transportation to Xinbuyang. And then when you arrive there and you have secured quarters and rations for your personnel, contact us and we will send the your personnel and supplies. Well, I went to Chabua and I contacted Major What's-His-Face, and he said, well, your people at headquarters are lacking some information. We do not fly into Xinbuyang. The Air Transport Command just doesn't. And I said, well, how do I get to Xinbuyang? And he said, well, offhand, I can tell you two ways. Over at our neighboring base of Dinjan, he said, that's a troop carrier command a base, and he said, they fly down into that area, and they, on the run, they kick out of the door rice for Stillwell's Chinese troops, mm-hmm. and then sometimes they will land at Xinbuyang and unload other supplies. Also, here's another way. He said, we have hospital planes that fly from, to Xinbuyang and pick up wounded Chinese soldiers and bring them back here to Chabua. So he said, that's probably what I would say is you ought to examine first. And I went to the operations office at the airstrip, and I made inquiries, and yes, I was able to rather shortly get on a hospital plane and ride with the army nurses down to Xinbuyang. And then once I was at Xinbuyang, in the 2 to 3 months I was there, I would occasionally have errands back up to India, and I would jump in the back of a C-47, and it was only a half-hour flight back to Chabua over the Naga Hills, and this was forested jungle. You might call them mountains, but not too large mountains. If anything went wrong, you better have a parachute, because you couldn't do anything but jump out. And, to get back to my subject a little bit. Yeah, when I got down to Xinbuyang, I've had to find quarters for my men, and quarters for the weather stations. Well, there was a squadron of P-40 fighter planes there, And I went to their head guy, who was perhaps a lieutenant colonel or possibly even a full colonel, and he said, "Well," he said, "I can, I can feed your men." See, we were only looking at, my personnel was only about 6 enlisted men, mm-hmm. plus myself. Mm-hmm. And then he said, "There's some British Army tents here in the, right here in our area that are unoccupied, and I see no reason why you can't occupy mm-hmm. them." And then I remember I was talking to I believe he was a lieutenant colonel in the engineer corps, and I was asking him, "Well, what about a facility for the weather station?" And he said, "Well," he said, he said, I too can feed your men," but he said, "As far as the weather station is concerned, well, all I can say is there's a whole jungle full of bamboo out there. Just have at it." And I found that the operations office, you know, there were planes landing, sure. taking off there, and their headquarters was made out of bamboo. They flattened the bamboo into mm-hmm. strips, which mm-hmm. would be even 7-8 inches mm-hmm. wide, and then they wove these together for the sides, mm-hmm. and then there was no thatching material available, but they used tarps, mm-hmm. you know, for ceilings. Mm-hmm. Well, one other quick comment about greater cooperation from the higher ranked officers. Conflict ended about mid August, and it was a little over a month later before I left China to return home. And I never ever did get a leave. Mm-hmm. Well, I will mention very quickly kind of an unofficial leave. I was stationed just out of Chongqing, the wartime capital, only about 25 miles from the wartime capital to Chongqing, and we were in the backwoods of China. Yeah. In Chongqing, I always had difficulty, even downtown in the banking district, these big banks, I had a hard time finding anybody that spoke English. Mm-hmm. Well, I knew I was going home soon, so it was getting towards mid-September, and somebody mentioned that one of our colonels, a Colonel Graves, he was a full colonel, they said he's flying a B-25 out to Shanghai tomorrow, maybe the next day or mm-hmm. whatever. I said, "Oh, really?" Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I thought I'd like to get a little look at civilized China, sure. before I left. So I hunted up Colonel Graves, and I said, "Colonel, I'm told that in a day or two you're going to fly B-25 out to Shanghai. Do you have room for me to ride along?" He says, "Yeah, sure." He says, "We'll take off at 8:30 a.m. Mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. or whatever. Be there." Sure. And that was it. Well, if the person flying this plane out there had been another first lieutenant like I was, or maybe even a captain, he would have said, well, show me your orders.
Yeah.
With the full colonel, no problem. He said, yes, we've got room, come along.
Sure.
And, you know, there was no orders. It wasn't not an official leave, but I got to spend 2 to 3 days in Shanghai, and very enlightening. Gosh, even the many of the rickshaw coolies in Shanghai spoke English.
Okay.
Yeah, modern city. I stayed at a park hotel, and a nice hotel. One full floor was devoted to Chinese Chinese dining, and another floor, it was American-style dining, you know.
So they were all set up.
Yeah, and there were some nightclubs in China, and they had hostesses. They were white Russian girls that had fled down from Harbin, Manchuria, when the Japanese invaded Manchuria. White Russian girls from Harbin. Moved down to China, and you know, in nightclubs they were hostesses, and of course it was a rip-off. It seemed good to us to talk to a white girl, and of course you'd order something to drink, and they'd order something to drink, but you got liquor, and what they got was just plain old tea, and you paid for it as though it was liquor. Still, you didn't mind because it was what it was. So anyway, enough of that.
Well, then you were ready to go on home. You started shipping out in less than a month then to go back after the war was over.
It was around just a little after mid-September that I got the telegram from my headquarters in Calcutta, this was, and it said, inventory, station equipment, and turn over, sign over station equipment to Lieutenant Vincent Motto when he arrives in Peixi, and then proceed PCS, which means permanent change of station, to Calcutta, you know, for transport through the U.S. and all that. And believe me, I had that station equipment. There was publications and moonrise, moonset tables and some books and stuff and a lot of various stuff. Sure. And boy, the minute that fellow stepped off the plane, I led him into the weather station and I said, well, check it all out, be sure to cheer if you wish, but this is where you sign, and as soon as I could get on a plane to, I went down to Kunming first, and then of course with the war being over, we didn't have to fly the hump again.
No.
We didn't have to fly over to Assam. We were able to fly directly from Kunming to Calcutta over low country, of course.
And then you went by ship back to the U.S. again?
A staging area just outside Calcutta for, probably a week, 10 days or got on the ship, and that's staging area, the chow line one night. Here I spotted a fella that was president of the Associated Students of Montana State University. See, I was in he was a senior, student body, and we weren't acquainted, but he was a big wheel on campus.
Yes, that's right.
I knew him, and so I walked him up to him and said, "Well, how aren't you a long ways from home?" And so on. Kind of interesting to
bump into people like that. Well, then when you got back, when did you return to San Diego or San Francisco, or when you came back?
When I came back, we docked in New York City.
Oh, you came back to New York.
And I had never been too, as I said, my first base was in Louisville, Kentucky, and I'd never been farther east than that. So here we docked in New York, which I liked, and
did they discharge you then right away before you?
No, we got off the ship, and I had orders to go back to my home in Montana on leave, and then. After a couple weeks, my orders said to proceed to Seymour Johnson Field at Goldsboro, North Carolina, for discharge. And I probably wasn't the most faithful son. I guess I was supposed to, as soon as we got ashore and on our own in New York City, I was supposed to pick up a telephone and call my parents. But I didn't want them meeting every train that pulled into Weibo, Montana.
Right.
For the next week or so. I've never been to New York City.
Yeah.
And some of us fellas that were on the boat, we saw the sights.
Good for you.
And then I got on a train and I went to Chicago, where I had an aunt still. When I was at the University of Chicago, I had an aunt in Chicago, which was good. And I stopped at my aunt's for a few days in Chicago. And then in due time, I got on a train, and then I got on a train to Chicago, slept all the way, so we got to the Twin Cities, and then eventually the train went through
you went on the Northern Pacific, so we go through Fargo and Bismarck and
what's the town in Minnesota where the train stopped? Was it very
Staples, Minnesota?
Staples.
Yeah.
Yes. I'm trying to think of Staples. Yeah. When the train stopped in Staples, Minnesota, you see, this was the North Coast Limited, which is the fast train.
Right.
Didn't stop in the little places. No. Except that it stopped at Beach, North Dakota, just across the line from Weibo, 11 miles away. It stopped at the water tower, not at the station, but a few hundred yards away at the water tower, and they always took on water in Beach.
Oh, God.
And so when I got to Staples, Minnesota, I went into the station and I sent a telegram to my parents saying, meet North Coast Limited at beach tonight. And they'd always got in there about 11 p.m.
Uh-huh.
So they only had a few hours. maybe wasn't being a very good sign. Have I covered the ground?
Pretty much now. And then when you came back, you did the teaching right away, or
After a few days, after
that
time
of week, yeah.
Incidentally, I wired the base at Seymour Johnson. And I said it was my understanding that other returnees from overseas were being given 30 days at home before reporting for discharge.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I'm requesting an additional 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And I got telegrammed back, and that was granted. And so, after a few days, I eventually came up to Bozeman to visit, and I walked into the mathematics department, and the then head of the math department asked me if I wanted a job teaching spring quarter. I didn't know about all this GI
stuff that's going on. Yeah,
all the course, you know.
They had to
offer a lot of elementary mathematics courses.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And for something better to do, I accepted that.
Rest is history. Okay.
Yeah.
This is the finish of the interview with Bill Schwartz on November 16th, 2005. Gee, Bill, thank you so much for all this good information.
You're welcome, Charlie. It's been a pleasure.
And you fill both sides of the tape recorder right to the wire here. We're about ready to shut up. Thanks so much.